let me. So what I'm going to talk about is decays, or hadronic transitions generally. I'm not talking about weak decays, things like semileptonic decays. I mean, they're a special case, but a much easier case of what I'm talking about. And the basic problem has been known for a long time. And it's because we're doing things in Euclidean. I don't know whether you spell Euclidean. Because you have those who spell with an I and those who spell with an E.
I have an I in this case. E is in Hermitian.
All right. That an American knows how to spell has always amazed me, but there we go.
Well, the guy's name is Euclid.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah, whereas Hermite, Hermitian, yeah, anyway.
E.
Yeah,
yeah. It's E.
There appears to be the usual Europe-United States divide here, okay. Anyway, this guy, the problem is that this is nothing to do with the lattice yet, Euclidean, but it's Euclidean. The problem is, imagine some decay like rho to pi pi. Then we have some 2 pi threshold in the energy plane, and instead of drawing the imaginary part, I'm actually going to draw like the spectral function. That's the sort of density of states. And it's a threshold, there'll be some bump like this, and this corresponds to the m rho, right? So this is something some of you may not be old enough to know, but. All right. And what happens when you look at the correlator goes like e to the minus the energy times t. Now I'm talking about the correlator in time when this is the spectrum. And it will be dominated by the 2m pi, which is the lighter state. It's dominated by the threshold end because the exponential decay, the lightest particle drops off least far. And so actually you just don't see the rho. I mean, if you were to measure such a thing on a lattice, you'll learn everything there is to learn about the lighter states, which is not what you want. So that basically is the origin of why it's hard to just go straight ahead in Euclidean time and extract things about correlations. You tend to learn things about the decay. In Minkowski, because of various trickeries, it turns out that this end hardly matters and the thing is dominated by the bump, which is what my experiment looks like experiments. Okay, so that was in the continuum. Well, how can you fix this? One way to fix this is to use a finite box. This is known as the, I mean, some of this is the Mayani Tester no-go theorem, except there's no-go theorem. I mean, you can go, right?
You can.
Just an analytic
anyway. Yeah, all right. No, I mean, okay. So all right.
Chris Michael goes where Mayani
Tester theorem. That's it. That's it. You can come again. In fact, yeah, I'm not mistaken. Right.
I'm writing my trip report.
good. Right. In a finite box, this was pointed out by Lucia back in the early 90s. What happens is that, in fact, the continuum is misleading. There's a spectrum of two-body states. There's two pion states in the case of rho decay, the momentum has to be non-zero because it's a p-wave decay and it vanishes if the momentum is zero. There'll be states where momentum in some notation is sort of 1, 1, 0 and minus, that's supposed to be a minus, -1, -1. The lower state's got momentum 1 and in one direction, and then the next lower state's got momentum 1 in two directions and so on. So there's some spectrum that eventually gets quite dense. This is energy going this way, and this is nothing in particular going that way. And the rho meson is presumably somewhere here. I mean, and what happens is, as Lucia pointed out, is that what you do is you study very carefully. There will be some mixing between what you may think of as the rho before you turn on the decay and these states. And there will be some energy shifts here. So these levels will shift in energy because of interactions between the pions, because of the rho meson causes the pions to interact. And he came out with a formula for this. His formula says the following roughly. It actually is more detailed than that. So the energy of a two-pion state in a finite box relative to that in an infinite box is given by some factor, which I won't bother you with. The tangent of the phase shift in pi-pi scattering in the right quantum numbers divided by the volume of the box. And that's the sort of, you can roughly see why that is. If you think of your two pi's in a box of You have to imagine the third direction. Then most of the time, the two pions will be completely separated from each other, and there'll be no interaction. So there'll be no energy shift. So the energy shift will be like some, will go like 1/volume, because that's the sort of geometric factor for the pions to get on top of each other. And if pions are on top of each other, the phase shift is, roughly speaking, defined as that when something goes through the other thing, it's the change in phase. So it seems like it's the right thing that could appear. So
if you want something easier, you've got a pi level, but there's lots of states. So which pi?
Oh, the factor here includes the momentum.
So this is at some given...
This is for some particular level. For each level, the shift depends on the phase shift at that level. Right. So
the momentum thing at infinite volume is not the lowest. I mean, it's a different
variable. This formula as it stands works for all the levels.
There's a hidden variable k.
But the factor is 1/2 EK or something, and the phase shift will depend...
Both of those E's depend on k.
Yes. Yes, they do. Yeah. They absolutely. Yeah. Like so. Yeah. So, and what then Lucia says is that therefore you can learn what the phase shift is at this energy. You can actually sort of in principle plot out the versus energy, the phase shift, by measuring it at these points, and you will hopefully find that it goes through 90 degrees at m rho, and you therefore know the mass of the rho, and you'll know the rate at which it goes through 90 degrees is the width. So in principle, this is an old paper of Lucia in 91, I think, you can do this. I mean, if you measure the energies very accurately of the two-body system in a finite box, and then you track them out, you're home and dry. I don't believe anyone has ever done this, including Lucia, because it's just...
In simple theories, yes, the
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've also done it in simple theories, yeah. But not for a proper hadronic decay, a particle that experimentalists have heard of.
Right, but people have done it in the
IMS2 panel. Yeah, but then there's no decay, that's right, yeah. So pi plus. No, the formula has been used, but this application...
Including the fact that, the whole mapping out of delta.
Indeed. Yeah, the people looked at the lowest momentum in the next, and saw how it went, and so on. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, and there are corrections to this formula, you know, because Lucius never does anything by halves and exact known. And then at some point, that there, of course, the formula only applies if the things are reasonably small. And there's been much debate. We lattice people are not famously good at using small objects in large boxes. We tend to do it the other way around. So there's some worries as to whether we're in the validity range. Okay, so this is what we all, you know, ideally, if we had infinite computer time, we would not do staggered fermions, and we would do this, right? But, I mean, we don't have infinite time, so that's how it is. You know, there are compromises to be made, and this is the compromise. So the
can I make comments?
Just, yeah, go on.
Because it's important that there's just two-body decays.
Yeah. The Lucia formula says that once you reach the the 4-pion threshold, in this case, Lucia is not prepared to do any more. You're on your own, Squire.
Okay.
And there's some mixing between L equals 0 and L equals 4, which he's very worried about.
So, this is informal discussions. How do you know how many pions in your box? I mean, you've got a system with some box, you're measuring energy levels. How do you know it's 2 pions opposed to 4 pions?
Lucia would say is you create a state with the quantum numbers of 2 pions in a row in a P wave and all that jazz.
Presumably there is some 4-pion mixed in with that.
At an energy, yeah, and you study it at a place where we're below the real 4-pion threshold, so the 4 pions are only virtual.
I mean, if the 4 pions was there, it would still be okay.
That's the point that Steve was trying to make. I mean, technically, for rho, this will hold when the mass and box size is such that you can only have a row of 2 pions.
This formula extends the energy goes above the 4-pion threshold.
As Chris said, all bets are off.
Yeah, but you still have a discrete spectrum.
You have a discrete spectrum, and you.
Bunching of levels.
I mean, Lucia is not prepared to work there, but there are braver people who might when we ever need to.
I'm not going
to
do it.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, here's a comment. So you know these phase shifts arise an infinite volume by matching the scattering state onto an outgoing spherical wave. And so what Lucia did was replace the outgoing spherical wave with the two-body solutions on a torus. Okay? And so that's why the same phase shift, which is a short-range origin, comes into this formula. But sorting that out for multi-particle states is something
I think the best pedagogic description of this is actually due to Pierre. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, that's one that I got from somewhere. So I'm not going to do this. The reason that I'm not going to do this is, first of all, you have to do it in full QCD. This is not a thing you can do quench. You're actually measuring this energy shift will happen in quench, right? And you need a precision. I mean, the effect is very small. It's a one over volume effect. And you have to measure it very precisely. And that's not something we're typically very good at. Though I will, in a minute, come to some numbers. I mean, we did actually do this when we found the result was, you know, sort of 2 plus or minus 2 in some units, you know. So, I mean, okay. So, what I want to sort of, the issue I want to address is, can we cut through this? I mean, this method is the Lucia method, shortcut. Right. I can't do joined up writing very well, so I have to do non-joined up writing, right? Okay. Actually, my student assessments when I lecture, in the first year they all complain about my writing. And by the third year they don't complain about my writing, which just shows the students have learned something during 3 years of study. Right. So can we do something other than looking at the... Silence in the back now. Calm down. So the energies are a very good thing to look at. Energy is very well defined. We know exactly what we're doing. You know, it's just the sort of thing that Martin Lucia would be happy with. Can we actually look at wave functions? Can we look at transitions? And so what I'm going to address is in fact this picture. Let me use this. So let me be a bit more precise. In the spectrum, in a case that is available to me, pi 1, 1, pi naught minus 1. Okay, if I consider the following case where I have a rho meson which has non-zero momentum, it has momentum 1. The rho with momentum 1 will decay to 2 pions, or is coupled to, has the same quantum numbers as 2 pions, where 1 pion has momentum 1 and 1 naught, or they have momentum 2 and minus 1. The net momentum has to be conserved. And it turns out, in this case, the energy gap in lattices available to me with dynamical firms is quite small. That this is like decaying with momentum a half, because you know one's gaining a half in the center mass and one's losing half. And that's better than, it's got to be non-zero, so that's the best we can do. So that's a particularly favorable case. And this energy gap is really quite small. This is some stuff using dynamical UKQCD lattices. So let me focus on those two levels, because they're actually rather close, and everything else is quite a bit of a way away. So if we had a two-level system, what we would expect, does this esteemed establishment run to colored chalk? I think we have to... Are you listening to me? There's no colored chalk here. Oh, right. Oh, yes. Yeah, well spotted. Well spotted. Well spotted. What color should we vote for? Right. When we have... In quantum mechanics, when we have two levels which can mix, because the rho, if you like, was a rho before it, we turned on decays, if you like to think of it that way, and the two pis were not interacting before we introduced the rho phase shift. They will mix and the energies will shift. This shift is just the Lucia shift. So this is just what Lucia has been focusing on. This is we'll measure the shift between the finite energy and the infinite energy. A proxy for the infinite energy, by the way, is twice just the energy of one pion. Provided the box is big enough, because in infinite energy you'd expect that you don't actually have to go to infinite energy. Okay, so this is the Lucia shift. This shift is not normally observable, though I'll show you in special cases this is actually observable. But we could also measure the transition. Let's say we create something we think is a rho on a lattice, and we cause it to propagate to something we think is a 2π state on a lattice.
We start off with a system of, say, pions, which has a bunch of levels in this box. I guess I'm thinking in an old-fashioned physics way, where I'm now going to turn on the interaction between the pions instead of turning on the interaction between the quarks. There is no real row there. This level starts shifting around. So it's like...
That's right. In the Lucier approach, you don't talk about the row, you just talk about the phase shift, and then you just spot the
phase shift, right?
Yeah.
The phase shift turns on, and then yeah. There is another state.
Well,
I mean,
I don't want to quote Levinson's theorem at you or anything, but I mean, you know, if the phase shift goes through 90 degrees.
I mean,
yeah. Yeah, right.
You've already counted it in the pi states. Double counting when you throw it.
Right. So, okay, let me say it another way. If we wanted to measure this energy shift very accurately, it would be prudent to use operators which are like this. And operators with just quark anti-quark in, and use that as a variational basis. That would certainly be the right thing to do.
You're getting into the underlying theory now, that
yes.
It's quarks.
So yeah. So that would, because we know, I think we know, that the thing is going to, you know, in some limit, does have a quark anti-quark component as well as a four quark component. I am.
There was a time when we only talked about pions.
Yeah. It was my dream when I was allowed to do this, and now I'm allowed to, you know.
But Chris, do you actually see two levels or one level or one?
No. What you see is just levels, energy levels, and this is the lattice. We don't know what they are. They don't come with a little label saying I'm this, I am that.
I understand, but do you have two constant space levels?
No. In the world, in the light, okay, let me tell you what happens. When you actually study this, you find there are two close energy levels. And you can label them, you can call them what you like. But I mean, there are two levels. And in a quench theory, there would be, of course, exactly two because they don't interact. In the dynamical, we also find two.
Right. So that can be understood also over the
Lucius. Yes, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So I would think of it more in the old-fashioned way, where I'd start with a bunch of pion levels, and then when they turn on their action, they come down in bunch, and so it's one extra level which came out of that.
It's like the bounce state.
It's
a bounce state of
two pions.
It is actually a bounce state.
It's a clustering of pion levels.
Yeah, but it's a bounce state, mate, in our lattice. It's not decaying. It's not, in fact, it's never ever been seen to decay in anything being done up till now. I mean, if you like. Right. Okay. Let's say that we created something which, and let me draw this as a quark lines because I think we're going to need that. So what I mean by a row is something made of a quark and anti-quark, and what I mean of 2π is something like this. And so imagine that we measure a correlator between something that looks like 2π and something that looks like a row. And we ask that we're going to have to measure anyway in the along the way of doing the sort of variational thing to get this energy gap anyway. So it's something you've got to study that, right? Can that tell us anything directly? And well, at least sort of the naive picture would be, and anyone says naive, you must be suspicious about it, but anyway, that it goes like, oh, let me just call it 2π t minus t1. So I'm a transfer matrix person. This thing propagates as a row until it decays, makes a transition at some point. Transition amplitude, call it x, we don't know what it is. And then it carries on as 2π. So the amplitude that you would measure on a lattice for this off-diagonal transition at time t in Euclidean time, you'd expect to have that kind of behavior, yeah? And you can there'll be some constants out here to normalize the wave functions for these things, but by looking at the diagonal contributions, you can get rid of those. So you can, in principle, determine x. However, if this were really a weak transition, like this was k to pi L nu or something like that, a semi-leptonic transition, we'd know that we'd be putting an operator in here. As Steve says, we're not putting an operator in here. So we have to sum over t1, and that's where all the problems arise.
So what is the correlator you are studying?
It's just you just measure this. You create a row with momentum 1 at time 0, and you destroy 2π with momentum 1 and minus 1 at time t, and you don't know where t1 is.
Six.
Yeah, 2 goes to 4. Yeah. But that's what we measure that. Yeah.
Okay.
using stochastic methods, which is come and talk to me over coffee or something. You don't want to do that in public. All right. And the point is, you don't know where it, where this transition took place. So it's a sum, and because it's a sum, the thing that's going to want to, it can be right at the end. And if it's right at the end, the row's not gone any distance at all, and so excited states of a row contribute. Or it can be right at this end, and because it hasn't gone any time at all, any Euclidean time, there's no protection against excited states. So the danger of this is that we can get big excited state contamination. That's why this is not something that you just go ahead and do, and the referee says, yeah, lovely, and publishes it, right? You have, at first sight, this appears to be just a no-go, that we can't make any progress here. The sum will be dominated. If this thing is heavier, the thing will weight up that end, and if this thing's heavier, it will weight up that end.
The sum pushes you where
it's. Yeah. So you're already guessing the answer, but if, and only if, m rho is approximate equal to m2 pi, then the sum is flat. I mean, there's no particular weighting, and so you get a correlation that goes with an extensive factor of t times e to the minus the common mass, right? So it's the on-shell transitions are accessible to this naive trick. The anything off-shell, you strictly should Lucierize it, you know. So this is the shortcut, that it only works if you've got two levels close together and nothing else very, very near, and you can go ahead and do it.
You're saying you're on mass shell and Martin's off mass shell.
Actually, if you read what Martin's...
I read what Martin says.
Yeah, okay. I mean, in fact, there's been much debate. In principle, his method works... he's not off shell, but... Okay. You're just winding me up over there. Possibly. So what can we do with this? How does this work for the row to start with? All right, I'll give you some numbers. I think I'm down to the bottom of this page, so we're there. If I ask, and I'm going to quote the numbers as quoting these energy shifts, right? So, I mean, in lattice units, because I can get them from various ways. If I use the Lucier method, the energy shift is 0.02 in what we actually did in lattice units with an error of 2, which is an excellent determination, possibly one of the first, but not very precise, right? We didn't, we could have done better statistics, but it didn't seem like a good idea. This X thing comes out, you don't need to know what the number is, but so X is this transition. By actually looking at this, and then you can read off what X is, because you look at the linear behavior of, by the time you've normalized this by the two-body things, this factor's gone out, and you can just read off X. It's relatively well determined. However, it comes in squared, because this is second-order perturbation theory. So this is a by-the-by, and this implies a delta energy A, which is about 0.022, with the errors are rather asymmetric. So it's better than the Lucier method for the lower error. The upper error, actually, it's still quite large. So this is determining X from this, measuring this thing and extracting, using perturbation theory, basically, assuming X is small, which it is, to deduce the energy shift. And there's a third method for the row, and I'll explain briefly why that works. This is an idea that I think was first promulgated by the Milk collaboration. So some people might remember that.
So if you think that function, how do you get delta E back?
How do I get delta E? Oh, I do perturbation theory. I mean, I assume that I have a mass matrix which has got m rho, m2 pi, and x is basically just the off-diagonal element in the mass matrix, and I just diagonalize it. I use perturbation theory, if it's small.
Okay.
Yeah. So how can you measure the shift in the rho? Because how do you know what to compare it with? It's a single particle, and here it's, how can we tell how its energy is shifting? Well, there's a sneaky trick that the rho has momentum 1, so it has a preferred direction. It's going, let's say, in the x direction. But it also has spin. And if it's spinning in the x direction, its angular distribution will be a cos theta, and will throw its particle along the x direction. If it's spinning in a transverse direction, the angular distribution is a sine theta, and it's a zero along that direction. So the rho with momentum parallel to spin mixes with 2 pi, and the other one doesn't. That this is an artifact of this, the fact that the continuous spectrum is extremely discrete, and on the lattice we're actually breaking rotational symmetry for this particular case, but it's a trick we can use. So it actually turns out that this is the best way to get the best signal out of this, that you can, by taking the energy difference between the two sorts of rho, one that couples to 2 pi's, couples to this 2 pi state, and they all couple to other ones, and the other one which doesn't couple to this, you could get a split. And that's kind of cute, but it's not something that's going to work for you every day of the week. And the numbers all come out consistent, and you can deduce from this some coupling constant, and it's similar to experiment, and I mean, it's going to be, wasn't it? And, you know, read our papers to see more about that. So that's sort of the state of play for rho. The other thing I'd had thought to say was a couple of other applications. So it's maybe good to stop here and people say, well, you know, this is rubbish, or how could we do it better, or haven't you thought of this, or haven't you thought of that?
So can we do this for the physical masses?
Well, the requirement of the shortcut is that we have basically two levels that are fairly close. They don't have to be spot on. You can basically it's the uncertainty principle. This energy difference times the T range over which you want to measure things has to be smaller than one. You know, usual business, right? And one can certainly push this lighter. I don't personally have a lighter. I mean, and there's no reason why this isn't going to work when the rho gets just above, or the 2 pi's come down, you know, so it's going to work there.
There's another trick which might be by twisting in flavor space the boundary condition of one of the flavors and not on the other, you sort of can change the momentum that are carried by this guy. So I wonder whether using that twist you can make them come, will you like them closer? It's just kidding.
There's this, yeah, people are much concerned about this for k to pi pi, where, you know, you need a 7 Fermi box or something unless you do something clever, and so all kinds of people have gone off to do clever things. I think my answer to that is it's not worth it for the row, it might be for k to pi pi, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, we know the answer here, this is just a check, if you like, but these ideas people are very much aware of, that there are tricks where you can, at first sight, doing something for the up quark that you don't do for the down quark is a bit naughty, but, I mean, you can live a bit. Yeah, no.
Well, what I meant is, can you,
and so you can
get a really, even for the raw, a really good number by exploiting the fact that you can make the momentum.
You could tune it. You could tune it at a constant. Yeah, no, you're right.
And one sort of danger with that is that then you've got to do
dynamical. This has to be dynamical. Well, at least the Lucian method and this have to be dynamical. This actually is, since it's perturbative, you can do it partially quenched. So yeah, it's, I think you've actually got to do the simulation with the kinky boundary conditions, and that's not something that your favorite computer expert wants.
So you're happy. Different boundary conditions in the
sea. Well, it's partially quenched then, and then you have to.
No, I don't see that.
Yeah, I mean,
I have to think about it, but to me it looks.
Well, I thought about it.
The reaction is you don't need to do it.
Okay, I thought about it.
Even though you're not.
No, because when I'm thinking about final diagrams, you're also getting a fractional momentum from a external line. Which is fine. There is no reason to force a fractional momentum so on an internal closed loop line. There's no justification for doing that. No physics reason that I see. It's not like it's the case of the theory that you are screwing up the theory in the sense that you have different things going on external and internal line. It's just kosher to do it without putting it in the internal line.
Well,
I
don't know. In the Lucia method, for example, you know, the finite volume is what's driving the signal.
One paper with the periodic finite volume, another paper is using many periodic finite volume.
Well, no, so that's fine, but he's talking about the question.
Yeah.
No, I put on one
point. Only on the balance.
Right. Because I think that.
It can't be right. If you can create a state which is not in the vacuum, between you and me, it's partially quenched.
No, I was thinking about quantizing in a unit of 2 pi over 3, which then you can think about getting it, undoing it. But, you know, by Z, because it's a nice UN, but I think you're right. Because when you undo it, you undo it for everybody, so you're just moving the place from one place to another.
Suppose you do this, you get a nice number. How do I extrapolate to the physical world?
Well, it's a good question. You have two quarks, if you like, going on. I mean, you can arrange that this quark, I mean, provided it's in your C at least. And if you had a 2+1 simulation where you have, you know, down quark, strange quarks and so on. I mean, in principle, what we did anyway was just operate, do it with two different quark masses, completely full QCD, and we found that the reduced coupling constant, not the width, the reduced coupling constant, this thing G, was actually insensitive. And in fact, quoting some numbers, we got some number 1.5 in some convention for the coupling constant. And this is where, in fact, the quarks are no lighter than half strange, so they're not spectacularly light. And if you look at experiment, there is a case where the phi, for example, decays to KK bar, and so there's a light quark around here, but there's strange quarks outside, which is not the case we've done. And you actually find that the reduced coupling constant experimentally is 1.5. So it seems to be, and I find this hard to believe, actually, that for a vector meson to decay to two pseudoscalars, the amplitude, which is what G is, the coupling constant, is rather insensitive to the mass of the quark pair that's produced. That goes against your naive reaction. If you make heavier things, it's costly and you don't want to be doing it. But that's presumably the case for very heavy things, up to some mass, and maybe the strange quark is a good example, that there's the costs are not in the mass. The costs are in various other things, like breaking color and separating and so on. It is a little surprising to me that that's the case. In fact, as somebody who has been in the field quite a while, I discovered an old paper of mine where we did Reggie poles, and with Reggie poles, you could actually, there's some coupling between kaons and a rho by a Reggie pole exchange. And you can actually get at the coupling to rho KK, which is not physically allowed decay. And that's got a strange quark popping out of the vacuum in it. And by some complete coincidence, the numbers in that old paper agreed with this as well. But I mean, this is what I call nostalgia physics. I mean, you know, it's...
What's wrong with nostalgia?
It's good. I like it. I mean...
my question is simpler. It's just, that's interesting. But do I care what the raw mass is in the real world? If I did...
Oh. I think the answer that Lucia would give, the answer Lucia would give is that you're in maybe a state of sin to talk about the rho. You should just be looking at the 2 pi states and measure the phase shift and so on. Yeah.
But isn't this somehow a special case of Lucia where you've got these?
Yes. I mean, my formula agrees with his in the limit that you approximate to this. Yeah.
So you're not really doing anything not kosher.
No, I'm making more assumptions to simplify the working, and I'm getting a better signal. It's horses for courses, exactly.
I'm still a little bit worried about the excited states contributing. I agree that the excited 2 pi states will not contribute, but the excited rho...
No, they both can contribute. They will a priori both contribute.
And let's assume
the excited states go plus some y e to the minus e t if they have a common energy. So the excited states can contribute like that because they go nowhere, and then it goes as the other state the rest of the way.
Like T, but the problem.
But there's no T.
Yeah, but the excited state of the row can contribute proportional to T1 in the difference between the m2pi and the m rho. So if you work out what this formula is, you get e to the power m2pi minus m rho times T1, times e to the power minus m2pi times T. So the T dependence suppresses the excited states of the 2pi. But the rho, so an excited state of the rho will...
It's actually, the mass is symmetric. The mass is symmetric. Come and see me afterwards for a problem session. Yeah. Sorry. I worry, yeah, okay, but it's... You know, that's the problem, but it's what you get is the point is that the excited states are suppressed only by a power of T, not an exponential. And that's a bummer.
But then your formula is an approximate formula.
Then you're a bummer, but that's what you could do. So when did I start? I'm still in plenty of time. I was going to say was some other applications. So if people have had their money's worth of the row. So the other applications that I at least have been, this is just sheer advertising, but some of you might want to come and talk to me while I'm here, since I'm here for the rest of this month. Historically, the earliest one we did was one where there was no experimental data, which is always an advantage if you're doing lattice calculations. The hybrid meson between heavy quarks, so the gluonic field now is excited in some way. Let me just call that a hybrid meson between B quarks. That can decay. It turns out that it decays to a QQ bar state where this is a completely symmetric, not excited thing. It's actually the chi sub B plus the QQ bar meson, disconnected meson. It turns out the F0, the F0 meson is the one that we looked at the eta as well. So this is the de-excitation of a corkscrew-like string, which has got non-trivial angular momentum, to a boring string that's got no angular momentum, emitting a quark pair in order to conserve angular momentum, motherhood, and apple pie and things. And we've got a rate for that, and we've got a width in some arbitrary unit. I mean, it depends on some assumptions, of about 100 MeV for this, which meant that, you know, it's of interest to experimentalists who are planning to look at this in CC bar factories and so on. So that was sort of something that hadn't been done before. I already mentioned it as a small interjection that one can look at the heavy light system, and of course the diagrams are, I'm just drawing the net result, going to, for instance, a pseudoscalar meson, a pi or a k. And so the de-excitation of some excited B meson to a ground state B meson emitting a pseudoscalar meson. And the one that's interested us most was that's a 0 plus, and that's the usual lowest B. And that decay then, it may not be a decay if this is a strange quark, the light quark. It's most probably stable, but you can still measure the coupling constant. And in the case it emits a pi and this is a light quark, then it does decay, and you can predict the width. And we come up with some numbers which may or may not be the same as those of Einstein et al. Well, they are within a factor of 3, anyway. right. And what I've actually been banging my head against and making no progress with, if anybody wants to share a little head banging with me, I can do that. Not now, I mean, sometime in the office. I've been looking at decays of scalar mesons, which is quite an interest phenomenologically, because we don't really understand what the scalar mesons in the real world are to do with quarks. I mean, they're a bit of some conundrums there. And for the a naught to pi eta, this is something which in Quenched is a beautiful disaster. It's completely up the spout. Hestia knows more about this than most of us. And this is full QCD that I'm doing, and the decay proceeds, but with a the eta has got a disconnected contribution. Where eta here, I'm mostly doing this in NF equals 2. So the eta is the flavor singlet eta. My notation for eta means something you've got a flavor singlet component. The real eta is mostly eta 8, actually, but anyway. So we looked at that, and we get a signal. There's no problem about that. And in fact, because this will decay with momentum 0, because it's an S-wave decay, the it's closer to threshold. I mean, it's more or less on threshold, and so you know, the energy line up nicely. And I'm interested in sort of, have been interested in glue-ball decay and the like, or F0s goes to pi. And then there's the following beautiful little diagram, which is the noisiest diagram I've ever calculated, which is F0 goes to 2 pi, double disconnected diagram. And we've been measuring these things using stochastic methods and getting numbers and things and trying to interpret what's going on. The results are perplexing, by which I mean that it's very noisy, so it could all be down to inadequate statistics, or it could be down to something subtle going on. This stuff's not working properly. The spectrum is richer than we think, and trying to assume that there's only 2 states when there's 12 is wrong. And you know, it's altogether a moderately brave area to be in. And the assumptions are not necessarily all satisfied, but certainly the results are encouraging. And then you hit some daftnesses, and I don't, you know, at the moment that this is unpublished and has remained so for a year and a half because I can't quite suss out what's going on. That's something anyway that we want to, and eventually I would like to look at hybrid mesons, the light hybrid mesons. So this is again something that Milk people have commented on, that the hybrid meson couples two meson states, and it would be nice to try and sort that out in this framework. So that this is work in progress, that's work done. And that's it.
So, I mean, really naive person like me, if I wanted to figure out what the row was, would probably try to look at a current correlator and then try to fit it with some pion phase shift. I think I have some model where phase shift has a width and a. Is that just a stupid thing?
You're saying you create a row, how, is quark, anti-quark? Yeah, so, I mean, the current, that's where you make it. I mean, it's a gamma mu here and a gamma mu there, QQ bar. And that correlator is going to be dominated by that, though it can have doblies in the middle, right?
Right, exactly. So I would model this as 2 pion states where I put in some form to the 2 pion phase shift, which has a couple parameters, one the width and the.
Okay, well. It may not be what you were thinking I would say, but as it happens, I'm in a position to say something about this. You see, this actually, we did measure this diagram, and there are various other diagrams which, let me see. No, it goes the other way, actually. In principle, by studying that on a lattice, you could imagine that in this sort of transition thing that I'm talking about, you know, it makes a transition to a two-body state, then back again. And if these transitions x are relatively small as numbers, then it makes sense just to do it perturbatively and stop and so on. And so you can actually look to see if this sort of behavior occurs. That we've actually done and checked those things out, and they look sensible. I think I did it the other way around. I looked at the 2 pi. Yeah, I actually did this. Measured the box. And so you start with 2 pi. On a lattice, and then you look for the row bit in the middle. Yeah, and so we've actually done that. It's in the paper, in fact, and we get a value of x for this by making this sort of ansatz, and it's consistent. It's not the method of choice, but it's consistent. So
it's not the same as my because you're doing this two level analysis applied to this.
Yes.
You're not doing the complete.
No, you wanted to make a model.
Infinite volume,
right. All right, infinite volume. And it's all.
This correlator, and then this correlator, if I had some good model that I would.
Oh, okay, all right. So back to what was. So what happens is the two particle correlator, the sort of rho correlator, is e to the minus et rho of e. I lost some factors here. I've got to enter in D, I suppose. It's something like that.
So I'm going to put a model for
from 2 pi up. Yeah. And so It turns out that the inverse of this, what is it, Laplace transform or something, is numerically unstable.
No, certainly unstable. So
what you need to do is to make a model for this with a few parameters and get out. For instance, the maximum entropy method is such a model. I mean, I personally think it's based on nothing more than aspiration. Are you listening to me up there? But if anybody wants to fight me about it later, I'm willing to join in. And in fact, the very first paper ever written on this subject by me did that. And I built a model, and I fitted the model, and I got the width for a particle that was really decaying. And my lattice was, in fact, very big. It was 2 squared times 256. And it was effectively a one-dimensional lattice. And so I had a very small momentum, and it was more or less the continuum.
So why wouldn't I trust this kind of?
Well, because as you go to large T, this weights the bit of the thing that you don't trust.
Over, you have to know a range of T. You have to believe your model is small, it's smallish T.
Yeah. I mean, there is a school of thought of people who make fits using some continuum two-body stuff. And I think that's usually a little adventurous for the kind of volumes that we're actually working with. But, you know, eventually, for large volumes, it'll be the right thing to do.
Suppose if everything gives the same answer, we don't care.
Okay. But when you were answering Mike's question first, why didn't you look at the row one? That seems like the easy one.
Why didn't we look at this one?
Yes.
Oh, we did. It's just that in this case, you can separate out that diagram from the boring diagram where the two pi's just go straight through. And I think there's another diagram where they go through and swip. There's momentum labels on this. They flip momentum. There's no cross diagram. It's not allowed in this channel. But there's a box. So here we've got access, whereas in this case, there is only one diagram. You don't have a natural way to separate out the boring bit from the interacting bit, if you like. And it's going to be dominated by something. You're going to get 1 plus x squared, whereas here you get 1 plus x squared. But you can measure the x squared separately from the 1.
So is there any method to measure B to just two particles?
B to KK or something? No.
Yeah. They're not close enough.
No, I mean, we're talking with Chris that things like D to KK bar or something, you know, we could do, because there you can fiddle it up so they are a bit. No, I mean, it just tells you that basically something like the B to pi pi is a disaster area for the lattice. I mean, it needs new thinking. I mean, this is no help. I mean, other than it confirms what you already knew, that it's no help. I don't know what to do there. I mean, it's a disaster.
So you don't want to say anything more about this
Oh no! Just I've looked at this for different momenta, and it's just coming out inconsistent. I mean, you know, the results from when the momentum here you can have naught naught naught, or you can have naught one minus one, or you can have one naught one. There's several different momenta, and you'd like the picture to be such that I have in my mind that there's some effective Lagrangian with the coupling constant, and I wouldn't like the coupling constant to depend on the momentum too extravagantly. There are some subtleties here in these S wave decays. There's a sort of extra factor of mass in the coupling constant if you're a chiral perturbation man, which some people put in, and so there could be something funny going on. What's it called? It's the Adler zero is one of the old names for it, for those who've been around the block a while. So there could be that there's some structure that the simple-minded model of coupling constant times fields is wrong, and that's interesting, but it makes it hard to come to a conclusion.
Anyway, from a numerical point of view, you can.
There are signals. There are signals. And the signals here is excellent, so that you can do A0 to KK bar. The signal here is okay. The signal here is interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you can determine how big it is, and you can calculate how much of your lifetime you will need in order to improve it sufficiently that you can do anything with it.
Right, but in the other one, I mean, you really need that to get the theta mass right.
Well, I mean, we're doing all this in n(f) equals 2, which is not the real world, and we've already done the eta mass and checked that the eta is, in fact, unitary, comes up, it sort of saturates properly, and all that happens. So there is a proper eta in that theory. I mean, it's clover, and there's some drawback. The scalar mesons in clover are a little bit ill, actually, because of presumably, well, various deep reasons we could go into why there are phase transitions in field theories. But I mean, but clover seems to muck up the scalar mesons more than most. Well, clover with Wilson glue mucks them up. We've been actually redoing everything with CP PAX configurations because they've got Iwasaki glue in, and that actually gives surprisingly different results for the scalars, which is a warning that things are dodgy.
Thank you.